Texas values have to be reflected in the capital city. We cannot allow a state government to perform negligently or illegally. And we have to have a stronger hand on local government in the capital city.
Hey, everybody. It's Blue Grit Podcast. We are back today. Your co-host, Clint McNear and
Tyler Owen.
T.O., how are you, sir?
Good. Got a little chilly this morning. Had a little cold front move in.
Yeah, we're 81 day and snowing in the panhandle the next day. It's all good. Yeah.
Which, speaking of the panhandle, we got some filter upstated up there. We just got notified a couple days ago. It was like 300,000 acres on fire. Now we got notified today, this morning, 1.1 million acres are burning in our panhandle. Our hearts and prayers go out to those affected by that, our members who are fighting courageously through all that. Man, I just could not imagine going through that. We had a small fire in East Texas, but a fire that size, I could not imagine. So,
yeah. And with the state of our cattle industry right now, cattle prices, meat prices are going up. There's a lot of hay and cattle have been lost up there. So if you guys have resources or barbed wire or hay or whatever, you can get up there to those folks, spare feed or any support. Any support up there, those ranchers in that community could sure use some help right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And you guys, if you want to help out, speaking of the field reps that are going up there, you guys can help out by donating to our TNPA charities. Any members that are affected by that, we tend to kind of step in and fill that gap and fill that void by assisting those affected by natural disasters and so forth. So, again, our hearts and prayers go out to those affected.
Who we got today?
You know, God works in mysterious ways, and I think that in certain times, politics obviously are going on right now. We've got Super Tuesday coming up. TNPA stance against the current DA in Travis County, obviously, is we oppose him. And so I reached out to a young woman here that was, I guess we can call her a victim. She got re-victimized by Jose Garza's policies due to her cousin, who was brutally murdered in the 90s, and come to find out, the prosecutor on that case has been helping her along the way, because Jose Garza exonerated the man without notifying the family. And so I was introduced to a man named Terry Keel. Welcome to the stage. And we can continue to communicate and talk with her. And once I found out his background, I was like, hey, we've got a podcast I think you'd be interested in. And he agreed to come on. So, man, thank you so much. Former Travis County Sheriff, state rep. You've got a lengthy resume. So thank you for coming on. And
hey, thanks for
telling
having
us about
me.
You. Yeah.
No, it's great to be here. And I really appreciate TNPA. I want to do this before I forget, which is thank you and your organization. In 2003, you gave me the Legislative Excellence Award in the legislature, and I'll never forget that. And
I actually
have that posted on my website. So
that's
thank
cool.
you
yeah.
for that.
That's awesome.
Well, and speaking of state legislature, we commonly have our liaisons on here that walk the halls of the Capitol. It's so important for our members to understand the importance of our PAC and understand the importance, you being a former law enforcement and then filling that role of a state rep. I think we can start it off just real quick, and we'll kind of go back of where you grew up. But talk about the importance of how important is it for law enforcement associations to be involved with, state legislators, and to monitor those bills and have those relationships at the state level.
It's critical because it affects you in your day to day, unlike any other profession, because you're so vulnerable to civil and criminal liability if you don't have the support of your legislature. And fortunately in Texas, we have we've traditionally had a pro law enforcement legislature. And as a result, we've had success over the years in going to the legislature when we need to correct things. Now, we've never seen anything like we've seen in the last 3 years, especially here in Austin, where, for example, the legislature has had to step in to even put in procedures that never existed before in order to be able to remove a district attorney who commits misconduct. And we have a situation where the governor has been involved like never before in looking at specific matters going on in a county. We have the abuse of office by the district attorney here, who had indicted a whole slew of police officers, let most of them languish for over a year, and then dismissed the cases. Now, that's appalling. And I'm hoping the legislature, I'm hoping it gets their attention, those dismissals that occurred, because something more needs to be done. I mean, if I were an elected official in Austin, I'm a Republican, and let's just say if I were district attorney here and I had conducted myself the way he conducted himself, and let's say I, instead of police officers, was any other city or county officials you want to come up with that I charged with misconduct and I indicted, say, 21 of them, and then a year later I dismissed 17 of them. I'm going to tell you right now, I'd be in front of the local bar grievance committee.
Yes.
And I'd probably be under some sort of criminal investigation.
Official
myself.
Oppression or
Yeah, official something. Oppression, abuse of office. That, and the legislature needs to understand we are under siege. Law enforcement's under siege in Travis County, Texas.
Yes.
Well, and it's so disappointing. Numerous reasons, but two specific. You know, growing up my whole life, everybody in my family has been in law enforcement. My whole life, the district attorney's office and law enforcement, we're not exactly aligned in that, you know, we have to quote the same quotes and we're on the same team trying to accomplish the same mission
exactly.
of putting bad guys in jail. Yeah. And now it couldn't be any further from the truth.
He's an adversary.
Yep. And the scarier part is the weaponization of indictments. Indictments is not a tool to weaponize and pervert for political purposes. And to weaponize a tool like that.
Let me give you an example, a really glaring example of Jose Garza here in Travis County. He put out a mailer door to door where he said, I've fulfilled, you know, he's preaching to the Democratic primary voters. And he says, I've held police accountable. Do you know he doesn't have a successful prosecution of a police officer. All he's done is indicted them and then had to dismiss the bulk of them, which shows that he was wrong. And yet he is touting the fact that he ruined people's lives with false allegations because he dismissed those indictments for a reason. He couldn't convict them, even with juries in Travis County.
Well, and when you indict someone knowing you're never going to do anything additional,
you should be
further
removed
than
from
that,
office.
You have to be removed.
And cops hate bad cops just as bad as anybody else.
Absolutely. And police are already the most scrutinized profession in the world. In the United States, there's no other profession where when you act as a professional to use force, let's say, or deadly force, you're not only going to be scrutinized by your chain of command. You're not only going to be scrutinized by whatever internal special investigation unit there is for that type of conduct. You're not only going to be scrutinized by the internal affairs detail. In addition to that, we have a special investigations unit and an internal affairs detail in Austin Police Department. You're going to be scrutinized by the grand jury. You're going to be scrutinized by the United States attorney. You might be scrutinized by a federal grand jury and a state grand jury.
And the
There's
one
no
most
other
important.
Profession yeah. that does that. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, they create in the city of Austin another bureaucracy to investigate police, the police accountability bureaucracy within the city. And so then you add on top of that a district attorney whose aim is to disregard legitimate victims of crime. And I can tell you about that if you want to hear about that. But instead to prioritize prosecuting police officers who are trying to defend people from crime.
Yep.
And that's what we're living with right now in Austin, Texas.
We've got all that going on, but then you've also got the court of public opinion. And I will say, dealing with Austin, moving down here in Austin, Clint, you've dealt with Dallas. And I think we've seen a little bit of shift with media coverage in Dallas. I don't think it's as drastic as Austin. But the liberal coverage, as far as Austin's media, it's horrifying because they're trying to, you know, slant the narrative and slant what they want to see. But the court of public opinion tends to be the most impactful.
It's interesting because it's interesting you say that because in some parts of the country, the pendulum has gone so far askew on this subject that the citizens themselves, which are traditionally liberal, left wing voting groups, like in San Francisco, they actually recalled the DA, and they're now after the mayor because they're all being victimized. You can't walk around in San Francisco anymore, by the way. It's the city's been ruined and businesses are leaving. That's happening in large cities all over the United States because of this Soros prosecutor kind of approach. In Austin, I don't know. You know, I'm afraid that the constituency here is witnessing this. We've witnessed like the degradation of our city, and we see this crime going off the charts, and the police are don't even have enough police officers to make the calls anymore, and crimes don't even get reported anymore because you can't respond to them. And yet, I don't know that, you know, we have an election coming up on March 5th. I don't know if the citizens have suffered enough that the Democratic primary is going to throw this guy out in favor of somebody who's actually going to do a good job. It may be that we're going to have to suffer through this for a few more years before we get this fixed here. And, you know, there's an old saying, you know, the voters have spoken, now let the suffering begin. You know, and unfortunately, in Austin, because what you talk about, the press coverage, the local paper, the alternative newspaper, they are completely on board with that, with the anti-victim, anti-police, pro-criminal agenda that we've got here. Now, we do have some talk radio that's on top of it. And, you know, I noticed on social media, Austinites are getting fed up with this, but this could be a long suffering.
The weird part time. To watch, we've had a couple of guests on, and we're really close with some folks in Seattle at the police department in Seattle. And we talk often about Austin's about a year behind the Seattle experiment, the Minneapolis experiment, the San Francisco and the Portland experiment. They're about a year behind, which means Austin's had four examples of what not to do or how to turn back, but it continues. And I keep thinking these other places are already starting to realize we screwed up. Yeah. Seattle's starting to reelect conservatives again. San Francisco's recalling DAs. These other four places are beautiful examples, but Austin just keeps, we're going to make this bad experiment work.
Right.
And you keep thinking, Austin's full of reasonable people, smart people. There's a lot of educated people in Austin. And if I had four examples of what not to do, you seem like you would think at some point people go, oh, yeah, shit, we need to stop that.
We recognized this a few years ago that it was happening. And some of us, including people who were like former legislators and former staffers of the legislature, you know, we got together and we were talking about it. And we came up with a plan. We had no hope the city would turn around. Yeah. And I feel a little better now that maybe eventually it could happen. But at the time, we're like, this is in our lifetime never going to turn around. And we proposed, let's just take the capital city's police away from the city of Austin. They have been negligent. They have ruined the department. They have taken steps against the public's interest, and let's put it under the Department of Public Safety and say in the state of Texas, we're going to have the capital city governed by the Public Safety Commission of the Department of Public Safety. They'll set the budget. They will set the curriculum for the academy, and they will issue, you know, the badges for those.
So you were a state rep when that happened?
No, I did it. I did it as a former state rep and parliamentarian in conjunction with another parliamentarian. We gave a roadmap to Governor Abbott how to do that. And Governor Abbott, to his credit, a legislator sent it to Ledge Council and drafted the bill, but it didn't get introduced in the session. There was some halfway compromises where Governor Abbott just decided he just deployed DPS to Austin. As you see, they're down there in the entertainment district helping APD, and they're all over downtown helping APD because of the shortages we had with the negligence of the city council, the former mayor who was the worst mayor in the history of mayors, Adler.
Yes.
And so I think some people thought, you know, when a more moderate mayor came in, maybe things would turn around, and it's just not turning around fast enough. It's just very, very unfortunate what we're living with right now.
Well, and so for the listener that's listening, you're back. Let's dive off into who you are as a person, because I think that kind of legitimizes, you know, you speaking about the district attorney. Let's kind of go over your career path real quick and talk about how you started off, and then because we were just joking around a while ago, it's pretty lengthy. You were you started off with Travis County as SO.
Yeah.
Well, to start from the beginning, where'd you grow up? Where were you born? Who's Sid?
I love talking about that.
Who's Terry?
Great. I'm a fifth generation Austinite. My great great grandparents were Italian immigrants to Austin. Had a grocery store in East Austin at 1100 East 11th. And on my mother, on my maternal line, I go back five generations that has been here in Austin all that time.
Wow.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, it's unusual. I know some other people. There's just a handful of us like that. But, you know, I was born and raised here, and I went to Sacred Heart Catholic School, and then Pierce, what they would call middle school now, is junior high back then. And I went to Reagan and LBJ High Schools. And then I was an English major at the University of Texas, ended up in law school, attended UT and U of H Law School. And after I got my degree, I got out early, and I took the bar in February. And so I was licensed a little early, and I was given a early job as an assistant DA in Brazos County, Bryan, okay, Texas, and prosecuted there for about 15 months.
I'm sure you love being right next to College Station.
It was awesome. It was awesome back then. It was, yeah. You know, and used to go over to College Station a lot. But anyway, that was a blast. And I had been an intern in the Harris County DA's office before that. And so I knew I was given, I was second chair to two capital murder cases during that time with Travis Bryan, who was the DA. Then Ronnie Earle, who I knew. Ronnie Earle was kind of a celebrity to me. When growing up in Austin, Ronnie had been a municipal judge when Austin was a small town and had been a state rep. And then he had been elected DA. And it was kind of like, when I went to work for him, it was like going to work for a Hollywood movie star. You know, it was so cool working for him. And I after I'd been an assistant DA in Bryan for about a year and a half, I came here. And so that was just a wonderful thing. I ended up working for Ronnie for 8.5 years, and I ended up being over the major crimes division and being assigned the best assignment you could ever be assigned.
I imagine.
It was a wonderful time. And I got assigned to the Austin Police Department full time, physically housed with them in a special federally funded program called the Repeat Offender Program. So I went through police training with that unit and was physically housed with them and assisted in the actual field work that we did to follow, arrest, target, and prosecute
enhancements and targeting.
Yeah. And so it was a great unit.
And crime probably was suppressed.
Yeah, it was. We would do things like follow criminals around and catch them committing robberies before they could hurt anybody.
Wow. You know? Who would have thought that?
So, yeah, who would have thought that? It was a great thing, and we received a lot of accolades on that. They don't do that anymore, obviously.
Shocking.
So having done that, I got a lot of support from the Austin Police Department, and that's really how I got elected sheriff. I was elected sheriff in 1992 out of the DA's office, which was an unusual.
Wow. No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, and so in 1990, and I was the first Republican elected since the Civil War or something like that. So, I don't think any sheriff has ever been elected as a Republican other than me, even after the Civil War. So, anyway, it was shocking political. And I got to tell you, it was the police that it was all of the police came together and backed me in 1992 in the election cycle. It was the year that Bill Clinton trounced George H.W. Bush. It was like swimming upstream to win. Yeah. And a heavily Democrat county as a Republican candidate for sheriff, but we pulled it off. And so that was great. And towards the end of my 4 years, my chief deputy was Alvin Shaw, who was an 18-year veteran of the Austin Police Department, renowned homicide supervisor. He ended up running as the Republican on me for sheriff at the end of my sheriff term, and I was elected to the House of Representatives and ended up a decade there. And then after that, was brought back to be parliamentarian, and I then ended up being the executive director of a state agency, the Texas Facilities Commission, and for 5 years. And then Sid Miller, who is you were talking about the fires going on in West Texas right now. This gets us back to where I am now. For the last 9 years, I've been an executive working for the statewide elected official, Sid Miller. I'm his deputy commissioner, which is the top appointed official. We have about 700 employees engaged in the business of the Texas Department of Agriculture. We have 5 regional offices and a headquarters here in Austin. And so that's what we do. And that's what I'm doing now.
So 4 years as sheriff, 10 years as a state representative. Wow.
Yeah. And then 2 years as parliamentarian in the House. And then after that, coming back over to the north side of the Capitol complex in state.
Explain
agencies.
What the parliamentarian does, because some of our viewers or listeners may not understand what that position
so
is.
So I was chosen by Tom Craddock to come in the middle of a session when there was a huge revolt going on. The parliamentarian is appointed by the speaker to advise the speaker on matters of procedure of the House of Representatives and of constitutional law. So if you ever watch the proceedings of the House of Representatives, either at the Congress in Washington or in Austin, in the House of Representatives, the parliamentarian sits to the speaker's left and guides the speaker on what to say and what to do and how to rule. And so that it's a very
important,
it's a high level of public trust because you have to be honest and ethical in the position. And so that was a real honor to do that for Tom Craddock.
For our association members, it would be like Robert's Rules of Order advisor.
Exactly.
Reminding the speaker, hey, there's a point of order. This is how you handle a point of order or an amendment to an amendment to an amendment or kind of a senior advisor role, I suppose, to relate to that.
It is. And the position is such a position of trust with the speaker, at least it was back then, that you also have a heavy role in the actual administration of the speaker's office. And so it's a real important position.
Nice.
It was a lot of fun.
That's great.
But then that speaker was not reelected as speaker, and I went on to another role after that. But it's been a great career. I've been licensed as a lawyer since, it's been 40. I just figured 41 years. I can't even believe I'm saying that since I was licensed. So it's a real blessing to be here with you guys.
Yeah.
God has blessed us because none of us have been killed or indicted. So. Yeah. There you go.
And it brings back to the point, you know, when I was talking to him, I think we talked on the Sunday, we kind of knew that time was of the essence. And when I found out that you were representing, now for the listener and viewer out there, I want you to comprehend this. This man represented or actually went against the suspect in a case of a 91
homicide.
He was the prosecutor on the case and, To turn full circle to now represent that victim's cousin, you know, 20 years, 30 years later, to make sure that that victim's family has the justice that they need and to do it in such a manner of devotion and dedication. That victim, she and I text every single day, and the amount of respect and love that she's got for this man, it speaks volumes for your character. It speaks volumes for your dedication. And quite honestly, I'll just say it right now, it speaks volumes for your love for this city. And so and we share that with, you know, what's going on in Travis County. And what's mind boggling to me is that people continue to say, Austin's not the city that I grew up in. It's not the city that I knew. And so my encouragement to those people, you know, they're not like you and I, they're not voicing their opinion or Clint, they're not voicing their concerns is that, well, what are we going to do about it? We can't just let it fall like San Francisco and Seattle. We can't sit back and let this happen. You know, we serve in the Law Enforcement Association, and obviously, Terry, you serve in different roles. But it's just aggravating to sit back and let this happen.
Yeah, and a lot of people voice that. Even my wife, she's like, "Let's get the heck out of this city," because we get so frustrated with the politics here. But you know, I come from a large family, and my siblings and I were like, "We're not leaving. We're going to make a stand. Yeah. They're not getting rid of this. Is our town. We're not leaving." And I hope that eventually people see what's happening in some of these cities like San Francisco, Baltimore, Chicago, and they realize that we're on the wrong track here in Austin. And we're like you say, one of y'all said it, we're just behind them.
Yeah.
Barely. And, eventually we turn it around here. But I do notice, like, I'm raising my grandkids and I go to, you know, in public school, I go to a PTA meeting or whatever. And there's, you know, in the old days, I knew everyone there. Now it's a bunch of people who aren't from here who are at these kind of things. And I think I don't mind people coming from California. That's great. But I wish they would quit leaving the disaster and then coming here and voting the same way.
Yes.
Yep.
That's what frustrates me. I'm like, did you not learn anything from what you left?
Yes.
You know, and
you're welcome here. Just don't pack your politics with you when you make the trip.
The good news is Texas as a state, though, is becoming more conservative. And we're really making great strides with the Hispanic community. They are traditionally aligned with the values that, for example, the Republicans have, pro-life, pro-family. And that's why you're seeing the valley, you know, down in the valley. Some of these counties are slow. If you look at the map right now, it keeps creeping further south.
Yes.
These counties are going Republican. So it's kind of interesting.
Which I think the disconnected folks in D.C.
Yeah.
don't believe that. They think, well, if any Hispanic is going to vote, liberally.
And that's right. They're wrong. They're dead wrong.
Texas border is definitely not that way.
Well, the big miscalculation for them was they thought if they opened our borders, they would have a natural ally from the South Texas Hispanics that are you know, citizens of Texas, right. You know, and they just miscalculated because they are feeling the brunt of the disaster we're dealing with down there right now.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. As are the agricultural community and the ranchers and farmers, and they're being overrun. And so you go to these small towns, you know, you're talking about Christina Byington, she's from Falfurrias down there. And, and really there's, you might even have those counties that still tend towards voting in the Democratic primary, but if you talk to the people down there, they are the saviors of Texas because they're the remaining middle class. We've lost middle class in Austin. We've kind of run the middle class out of the city of Austin, but the middle class still exists in the rural areas of Texas, and it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Share briefly. We'll sidestep here and put a placeholder on the conversation because I want to talk about your involvement, dive into the Ms. Byington's case. But for our listeners, what is the Agriculture Department, the administration? What can you give a Cliff Notes version just so people understand what that is?
So the Texas Department of Agriculture is involved in all aspects of agriculture in the state, and our job is to promote agriculture and protect it. We also have a regulatory function. We regulate things like agriculture pesticide and even structural pesticide, like in homes, like when you get sprayed for bugs. Those people are licensed by our agency. We also have a huge trade and business development aspect to our agency, and we have a food and nutrition part of our agency, which is actually about 2/3 of our agency, and that has to do with feeding people who can't feed themselves, feeding kids in school, and summer meal programs, things like that. A lot of that is federally driven, that part of our agency. The other part is state driven, the things we do with farmers, ranchers, and consumers. When you go to the grocery store and you buy eggs, for example, those have been inspected by us and graded. So we have a metrology lab that sets standards on weights and measures. So it's a huge, Sid Miller, my boss, he likes to talk about that. We do so much that people don't realize. And I was shocked to know how much you guys are involved in. Yeah, and people are shocked how big. Our agency is not a big state agency. It's a medium size, but that means we have 700 employees. So that's, you know, big by, you know, any standard. Yes. So we have a lot going on every day. We have inspectors all over the state at our 5 regions, and they go out every day and they're inspecting. And we try to assist on anything that comes up agriculture related. In fact, my boss has been involved heavily right now on the wildfires that are going on up in West Texas, as has our regional office, as has our emergency response employee from Austin. So we're involved in that right now.
Also, before we jumped on, we were talking off record, and he had a lot of good things to say. So just a quick shout out to all of our special rangers over at the TSCRA and what they do to support our ranchers
Amazing people. Yeah. And we work with them. We have export pens. We deal with Mexico directly. Our agency does. We have Mexican veterinarians that come into our export facilities along the border, and we deal with them at our export pens. So all, for example, livestock exports that go out of the state of Texas into Mexico go through our agency's export pens.
Nice.
That's cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
Didn't know that.
I just want to share that. I wanted everybody to be sure we understood about our agriculture department. That's my background growing up and raising cattle. And
And we need to protect it. We're also, my boss is big on, we need to protect farming. There's a push at the nation, at the federal level, to hurt farmers and to hurt especially cattle ranchers and the ranching of cattle. Right now, they're pushing that.
Well, the United States supply of cattle right now is, I think it says it's at the numbers from 1971.
Yeah, we're low. Yeah.
And what that means to the consumers, when you go buy a pound of ground beef, it's going to double and triple, and it's going to continue to go up, because if there's not the quantity of cattle out there, it's got to come from somewhere.
Well, and if the feds have their way, they'll put us out of the cattle business. But we're pushing back big time. In the state of Texas, we are protecting that and all other aspects of agriculture. And we have a great, you know, ag commissioner And one good thing about Sid Miller is he came from the industry. A lot of people run for ag commissioner are not really from, they don't have an agriculture background. Right. He's the real deal.
Yeah.
And he ran for it for the real reasons.
Right.
That's awesome. Because of the subject matter.
Yeah.
So it's been a real honor working. I got to tell you, I've been there. I can't believe I've been there 9 years. I didn't intend for that to happen, but it did. And it's been a wonderful place to be.
That's awesome. That's
cool. I grew up going to my grandfather's farm in Tennessee and have a very modest agriculture background in that regard. But, you know, it just has been like coming home doing this job. It's been great. I used to, I guess I shouldn't say this, but I'll go ahead and say that our cash crop was tobacco. And so I, as a child, planted, you know, we'd get on the back of the tractor with the wheel and plant the tobacco seed.
Yeah.
And we had cattle. We had some cattle grazing and some corn growing on our property there. We were in the Cumberland River area of Stewart County, Tennessee.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
When I was a kid. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Gorgeous.
Loved it.
It's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. All right. We can jump out of that placeholder and jump back in. Well, talk to them about how you guys met and dive into some of that, because it's incredible.
I think also, real quick, you know, you having the DA office experience, Clint and I both regularly talk about this, is that what the current DA in Travis County, and quite honestly other counties in Texas, you know, with Kim Ogg, Creusot, and you know, Gonzalez, sometimes we find that the Soros-funded, you know, district attorneys are weaponizing the Texas Penal Code to fit their political agenda. And from a person who worked a long time in the DA's office, explain kind of what that looks like from your perspective, and then for our non-listeners, you know, what that means and how they're weaponizing it.
It's shocking.
Yeah.
You know, I worked for what was perceived at the time as a liberal Democrat, Ronnie Earl. Let me tell you what his highest priority as DA was. He believed in victims' rights. He believed in making the victim whole.
And in the past, that has been the liberal stance.
Yes, it was.
Victim-driven,
He was a pioneer in that. I went out with him to California where we went to all of these victims types of conferences, and he really was a leader in that. He was the one who established a victim's assistance office in the DA's office. It did not exist before Ronnie Earl. Wow. Ronnie Earl was actually a leader in the state of Texas on victims' rights and the attention of the prosecutors to the victims. So this is a complete change that we've seen with this Garza DA here in Austin. I mean, this is goes against it. They do not believe that the victim is a victim. They believe the charged street criminal is the victim because the system is systemically racist, and therefore their priority is to not incarcerate a criminal. Unless it's a police defendant.
Yes.
In which case, that is their priority.
Yep. And you can't make up some of the things that have occurred. It was sent to me probably 18 months ago, a clipping of a advertisement that Garza had put out seeking, if you are interested in moving to Texas to prosecute police officers,
first assistant.
Apply here. And I thought, surely that's a joke. Somebody has doctored that. Sure. That's the truth.
They were caught. They were caught because it's amateur hour at the DA's office right now. The people he has working for him in the highest levels in most of the office do not have backgrounds. Well, they don't. They don't have backgrounds as prosecutors or law enforcement. They come from either a labor law or public defender type background. And so they really don't know what they're doing. I'm sure that assistant DA who put that out, he said, we're seeking people to go after a particular profession here. Doesn't even recognize the unethical nature of that statement by a prosecutor.
Well, I'm going to talk about her. Let's
talk. That seems
about
almost
her.
Discriminatory. Yeah.
Naming
someone you want to target criminally.
Well, it would be like let's say a Republican DA got elected and said, we're going to start prosecuting these teachers in public schools. So I need people that are willing to do this.
Yep.
That's exactly what that is.
Yes, sir.
So her name is Trudy Schumberger.
I don't know that. I've met that person in passing, but I don't know.
She's the one that sent the email out to New York.
Yeah.
And in our, in my research with dealing with this, she's married to a gentleman named Ben Wolf, but 50% of the staff that Jose Garza hired all came from Innocence Project type law firms.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And which, by the way, at a national level is heavily funded by George Soros.
Yes.
Did you know that?
Yep. Yeah. 100%. And then what
dark money contributions fund the Innocence Project's national efforts. That's
explain right. Dark money for our listeners that don't know politics.
Well, we're in a situation in the United States right now where there's a lot of nonprofits that are set up, and they are exempt from the ordinary disclosures that, for example, a for-profit or a politician running for office would be in terms of disclosing contributors. So they're able to set up a thing like the Tides Foundation or some other nice sounding name of something that and there's a huge money that goes into those by these rich oligarchs that fund these things and fund these costs, and then they in turn give money out.
Yeah.
To do, for example, the DA here was elected largely through special interest money like that, through groups that spent a total of like $500,000 on a local DA race to get him elected. And there's no accounting for it. You don't know who gave that money exactly. You just know the groups, the nonprofit groups that did it. And so,
which trace back usually to a handful of people.
By admission, sometimes George Soros will speak and he'll admit, like he admitted, you know, that he was giving big money to the, you know, Innocence Project, you know, at one point up in New York. And, but anyway, it's dark money. In other words, Austin's local official in that case was elected by money that wasn't from Austin.
Probably not from Texas.
Right. Yeah. Mm-mm. And yet, he's got the local Democrat machine behind him on reelection right now. Yeah, against Celestine. I'm hoping Celestine wins in that primary, but I'm not in that party, and I don't have any control over it. I just hope enough people with common sense in the Democratic Party go, we've got to stop this.
I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful reasonable people of Austin are starting to take notice. The quiet majority of reasonable people I think are slowly getting moved to act.
Yep.
I hope. I'm hopeful.
I think so too. I just don't know how soon. It may take a few more years. You know, we may have to go the San Francisco way where it gets so bad that the one thing we kind of got going against us is how good our state government is, and you see all the cranes building buildings in downtown Austin, which shows a very good economy for our cities. You know, construction and businesses. We're not having buildings abandoned like San Francisco. But the state government needs to understand if at some point the state of Texas, I hope Governor Abbott hears this, at some point the state is going to have to step in and say, Texas values have to be reflected in the capital city. We cannot allow a state government to perform negligently or illegally, which in some cases they have, and we have to have a stronger hand on local government in the capital city by the state. And a lot of people, you're taking away local control. Let me tell you something, that you have no local control on the city of Austin Police Department anymore. It has been decimated.
Yes,
it is run by unelected bureaucrats now.
Yep.
That are deep inside, not the police department, that are deep inside the city. And it is absolutely been a disaster. The underfunding, the chronic underfunding, the state did address all that. If you'll remember, they passed bills and said, we're going to cut your state funds. Yep. If you, but at some point we're going to have to recognize in Austin that the city is not going to fix it.
My heart goes out to, we're friends with Michael Bullock and, over at the APA, the president of the APA, and my heart goes out to the men and women at the APD. But sadly, I admire the hell out of them. But by self-admission, I don't think I could have stayed. And I respect that they're all staying.
Let me tell you how bad it is. It used to be in the 90s and in the 2000s and even early 2000s, the most coveted local political endorsement anyone could get would be the Austin Police Department's APA endorsement. They now have politicians here now run from that endorsement because it's been demonized.
Yep. Wow.
And they have been so abused, the police department and the Austin Police Association, they've been so abused that their own city council doesn't want their endorsement. Now, I never thought I'd live to see that day.
What a statement.
That's where we're at now, and that's how wacky our city council is.
Was that prior to the George Floyd incident at times? Or was
they started handing money back around that George Floyd time because they were running so hard. I'm talking about the elected official, the city council, running so hard to the left that they did crazy things like cut one third of the agents, the Austin Police Department, started putting people's lives in danger, started, disavowing any money being taken from the political action committee of the police department, of the police officers of the city.
Which is an incident that didn't even happen inside. And I've said this time and time again, and for an incident that didn't even happen in Austin, did not happen in Travis County. It didn't happen in Texas. And we're still reaping. Well,
then the Thin Blue Line is called upon to save the city from riots that were burning buildings, were vandalizing vehicles and burning vehicles, threatening to go on into property and hurt people. They get out there, they do a great job, and what happens? How many of them now?
21 were indicted.
21 indicted.
Yeah.
And of course, none of them are guilty of anything, but their lives have been destroyed. And that's the city we live in, and we're putting up with that. Folks, you got to get rid of this DA.
Well, then you have Kassar, who wants to disavow the police, but then immediately ask for extra patrol in his home.
Yeah, here he lives and just north of Caney Glen, and he's asking for special protection while his neighbors are out there living his policies of being their cars being broken into and their houses burglarized. But he wants special protection. What a hypocrite.
Yeah.
Do away with the police, but send a few over to my house if you don't mind.
Yeah, these people are hypocrites. Same thing with Garza. He's got to have a little special dignitary protection squad for him. But the heck with the ordinary run-of-the-mill citizens of this town.
Real quick, what do you know about the Office of Forensic and Capital Writs, if anything? Is that a state-funded office?
It is. That was created. It is mostly, I think, the Court of Criminal Appeals deals with it. They are set up solely to help with writs of habeas corpus for indigent capital defendants who are on death row.
Okay. Would it you working at a DA's office, hypothetically speaking, that if you were to go or be involved with a case, even not so much directly in the trial, would you have to divulge that information to the courts that if your spouse worked for that agency, would that be something the courts or the defense would need to know?
I think if you were an attorney in a capital murder case where you're seeking the death penalty, most definitely. But here's the deal. I don't think this DA's office will ever seek the death penalty because they are against – so they're supposed to be standing up for victims – and they're supposed to be prosecuting people pursuant to the law. They're not supposed to ignore aspects of the law. That's a state law now that the DA can be removed from office for doing that. But I'm going to guarantee you right now, that DA, no matter how heinous the murders, even if it is a multiple murder situation or a murder in the course of rape or kidnapping, he will not seek the death penalty.
Well, the jewelry store owners that were murdered in downtown, the son and girlfriend murdered the jewelry store folks.
Yeah.
They were taking a plea on capital offenses and it got held over. And then as soon as Garza got in office, they all pled to pretty much nothing when the previous DA had them pinned against the wall.
We spent a whole day
it's incredible
on the rapes and murders, the plea bargaining down that's going on. They're not prosecuting cases. They are giving away lenient sentences for violent crimes. This whole opposition to Garza in Austin that you see from victims is a genuine, it's not political. It's a genuine movement of victims because they're so offended by his office.
Yeah.
He doesn't care.
Well, the suspects are the victims, according to him, which re-victimizes the actual victims.
Exactly. Yeah. An aggravated robber who beats a store owner and steals their things and puts a gun in their mouth. He's the victim because he's a victim of the systemic system we have here, according to the DA's office. It's truly sick. It is.
But there's been historically a number of defendants, and it goes back to the You know, back, there was, I guess, in, back in the 90s, you know, APD was accused of the homicide, you know, investigations that were, I guess, supposed to be overturned. Is the articles that I read, that's what they blame it on. But historically, how many cases has Garza overturned on capital murder offenses with defendants since he's been in office?
You know,
I don't have the statistics either.
They are trying to overturn not just capital cases, everything they can. They're trying. Then this gets to the Byington case, which, you know, I've only come back from state government on my own time, by the way, taking my own vacation to come back and do two cases. One was I defended along with Brad Heilman, Officer Stallings, in October of 2022. We took it to jury. He had, this DA's office was trying to convict him on a felony, multiple counts, and try to ruin him and brand him a criminal. We got an acquittal from the jury in October.
That was an Austin police
officer? That was an Austin police officer. And that was one I came back on and did. And then the only other time is I was asked by the victim's family in this Byington case to come help them. And they're not even a party to the proceeding. They are just the victim. And I helped this family. I've helped this family. We filed an amicus brief in this case. And just so your listeners will know, we had a situation where in 1991, we had a horrible homicide in Austin where a beautiful young lady was murdered. And her name was Anita Byington. And I was one of the prosecutors on the case. And the case went to jury in 1992. He was convicted.
Fully confessed?
Fully confessed, convicted. It was upheld on appeal in an opinion that scrutinized all the evidence. And it was declined review by the Court of Criminal Appeals. So it's a solid conviction.
Yes.
This office, this Garza office, has paired with the Innocence Project, surprise, surprise, and without marshaling competitive evidence, looking at, in other words, the inculpatory evidence, completely a one-sided presentation was made in secret for a year in front of a district judge, filing things in secret in a proceeding, an 1107 writ, which by law is supposed to be public, but was kept secret for a year, and from the get-go, from the first document filed by the DA's office, took the side of the criminal. Now, your listeners may not believe this. I'm telling you, the first document they filed a year before these documents, we found out about them, the DA's office agreed with the Innocence Project before one witness had even been put on the stand in the rehearing.
Of course they did.
And did nothing to underscore or point to the inculpatory evidence. And this went on behind the scenes in against state law, which mandates 1107 hearing is public, went on in secret for a year. This was not a grand jury proceeding, which was how you would normally do this,
right,
if you want to keep it secret. This was a mandated public proceeding that was held in secret. My client, Christina Byington, Anita Byington's cousin, And Anita Byington's best friend got a hold of me, and they said,
"Who's basically like a sister." I mean, she's
She was like a sister to a Fancy Green, and they got a hold of me, and this was last fall, and they said, "Terry, are you aware that this is going on?" I said, "Yeah, I am, because I got contacted by the DA's office, and they wanted an affidavit from me, and it was a real obviously it was an affidavit that wasn't telling the whole story. And I gave them an affidavit, but it wasn't what they wanted." And so they said, "What are they up to?" And I said, "I think they are trying to exonerate this guy. And I don't think they're conducting a fair hearing." And I said, "I hope I'm wrong." Well, make a long story short, because I don't want to, this is kind of insider baseball, but to make a long story short, once we started looking into it, we found out our nightmare was in fact correct. They weren't doing a fair, measured examination of the old case. They were doing everything one-sided to show that he should be exonerated. And in doing so, they left out all the inculpatory evidence. So it has been representatives of the killer, that being the Innocence Project attorneys and the district attorney's office, they're on the same side. There is no party to the proceeding saying, "Whoa, wait a minute. What about the so anyway, I won't get into the details of it, but it's appalling.
Was there anybody from the Office of Capital and Forensic Writs?
They wouldn't be involved in that case because this was a first-degree murder. It didn't involve the death penalty. This was in 1991. She was beaten to death, Anita Byington, and it resulted in murder of the first degree.
Gotcha. Okay.
But anyway, the only reason I bring up these details, you had asked about it, and by the way, Christina Byington, Fancy Green, those just two extraordinary women. Yeah. It's just amazing that I've kind of gotten to know Christina and rekindled a friendship with Fancy because these women are really strong, and the DA's office miscalculated this because they treated the victim's family horribly. They lied to them. They misled them. They didn't inform. There's a whole constitutional amendment that gives victims rights. Every single right a victim's family would have in this case was violated by Garza's DA's office. Yeah. They didn't communicate with them. They didn't tell them what their true intent was. They lied to them when they said, no, we haven't made up our mind about what the outcome of this, because Christina was smart enough to ask those questions.
Yeah.
And then I said, hey, Christina, look at this. In November 2022, they already filed a the very first answer they filed agreed with the killer, his position on the case. And so the only thing we have, fortunately, I'll wrap this up because I don't want to take up too much. So fortunately, the ultimate decider on this will be the Court of Criminal Appeals, and they are a court of integrity, as everyone knows. So it's they will get a shot at this, and you better believe the victim's family is going to be heard.
But the killer's walking free right now.
Yeah, he got paroled out anyway. He had been out on parole in due course. And so he got out literally at the same time they started this whole exoneration thing up. And they used him as a advertisement for raising money for the Innocence Project, implying that he was innocent.
Wow.
Before the hearing even started or evidence was even marshaled.
And to be clear, Travis County taxpayers' monies
are paying
for the district attorney's office to 100%. Act as defense counsel.
And to abuse victims' families.
That happening, but they also have eight prosecutors employed on a state grant that Travis County matches for their salaries to essentially open old cases like that.
For the
Innocence Project.
And let me say this, because Ronnie Earle did this. He did go back and tried to look at cases to find out, did we make a mistake? Because I'm going to tell you, I prosecuted over 50 cases to conclusion, and I would be the first one to want to know if anybody innocent was, and I would be the first in line to. But they did it right under Ronnie Earle's, review, and they even went back and redid cases with DNA and stuff like that. In this instance, Garza's office is not doing that. They are concluding the outcome and then marshaling evidence to lead to that conclusion. They're not genuinely exploring the conviction. They are trying to come to a conclusion, and they prove it with what they file.
Yes.
They themselves they've admitted it.
Is there a personal tie to this defendant specific, or what caused them to fly his flag so aggressively?
Because the Innocence Project took it up, and they got a federal grant to and I don't know the details of it. I know the office has some sort of grant in conjunction with the Innocence Project on this case, or that this case applies to. So it's
follow the money.
Yes, and I haven't looked into that aspect.
But the grant was co-signed or co-authored supposedly by Kazar.
Let's see, you know more about it than I do. See, I haven't looked at. I've been focused on the old criminal case, and so I've gone back and I've looked at all of the old evidence in this case, and I've assisted Christina in filing what's called an amicus brief because we're not a party. All we can do is do a friend of the court brief, which we did, which exposes all of this that I've been talking about the DA's office. But the outcome is sealed. I mean, the outcome is certain because the judge has no other evidence except what Causey's advocates and the DA's office are advocating in joint, advocacy. Yeah. So it's gonna end up at the Court of Criminal Appeals, and hopefully the Court of Criminal Appeals will look at it and go, oh my God, what the heck is going on in Austin, Texas? And I think they will. I think that when the Court of Criminal Appeals gets done with this, if this goes into Garza's second term, I think this is going to be grounds potentially for someone to seek to remove him from office because that's how egregious the victim's rights have been violated in this case and how wrong the evidence has been presented in terms of being one-sided.
And slanted, yeah.
Oh, yeah, man. So, you know, I let him go. Let him make his mistakes.
It's criminal behavior.
It's awful. So, you know, I'm just a full-time state official, so I can only do this stuff as a hobby. But
yeah, but I mean, for the fact that you take vacation out of your time, you know, to do that.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I got to tell you, getting to know Christina Byington and you know, it's just been great. You know, and she's all over social media and has done a lot of work. She's got an article on Medium. I don't have the site, but anyway, it's
I can post it on this YouTube channel.
And it's great.
It is great.
You know, she says the DA's move to pervert justice and writes the whole story. This could be a book. I hope she writes a book. I'm telling her, you need to write a book about this because no one would believe how she's been treated.
Yeah.
They thought she was stupid. See, they thought they could fool her.
Yep.
She's brilliant. She's brilliant. And she called them on everything.
What a testament to her love for her family.
Oh, my gosh.
To fight.
You know, she's there where Anita's buried in Falfurrias, Texas, and where the whole family. I knew Anita's parents real well because Ronnie had asked me to help with that family after the case was ended. And I actually was sheriff at the time, and then I was state representative, and he knew I had a good relationship with Sonny and Sarah, who were Anita's parents. And so that was something I've never talked about, but I had assisted Ronnie on some of these victims, with some of these victims on cases years after I was no longer there. And I just felt an obligation to help the family when they got in touch with me again. And I was hoping I was wrong. I said, you know, I think this DA's office is going to stack the deck and try to do something bad here. And I hope I'm wrong. But boy, we were right. We were absolutely right on it.
Wow. That's crazy.
The citizens of this town have no idea what's going on at that office.
Yeah. It's sad.
Yeah, it is. It's
sad. That's kind of a brief kind of summary of how you and I met. And, man, you know, I said this at the beginning of this podcast, God works mysterious ways.
Yeah.
And who would have thought on a Sunday afternoon you and I would connect, and the background again of Terry's just, man, it's remarkable. So
I got three questions to throw at you. What would, we'll say you're 50 years old.
I'm 66.
What would 66, you look great for 66.
Thank you.
What would 66 Terry tell 16-year-old Terry?
You know, I think I think I'd tell 16-year-old Terry, stay in school and which I did, fortunately, because I had a good influence from my parents. I say your schooling is really going to be your ticket to what you do in life, and they're not ever going to build statues to you, and no one's really going to remember you when you're gone. But your family will, and your family is what it's all about, especially your kids and your grandkids. That's what I'd tell 16-year-old Terry.
I like that.
You know, and you're not, you know, I always tell people, I hope I'm like, my grandfather lived to be 103, and we went to his funeral, and I remember being there, and he had outlived all his contemporaries. He was a World War I hero and great guy. This was the farmer I'd been with, and a very simple man, but wonderful man. Anyway, my point is, you know, I go to this funeral, and I'm sheriff at the time. This was back in the 90s when he died. And there's no one there that would have been his contemporaries, but it's a huge crowd of generations below him because they loved him so much. And so I was like, holy, I was struck by that. I was like, that, and it was mostly family, you know, and friends. And that's really what matters at the end of the day. Your professional life is secondary to that.
Yes.
And that's what you learn.
Well, and you said family matters in the end, and I think Christina is proving that.
She sure is. She's living it. Yeah.
She's proving
it. And, you know, it's been a wonderful thing reacquainting with her family and with Fancy, and that's been a lot of fun, but there's an undercurrent of real grief there that we all feel because we relive this from the 90s. But at the same time, there's a lot of joy.
Right.
And I think a lot of things she does is she says, what would Anita want me to do? And that gives her energy to take on some of these challenges, you know. Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. And, you know, when you're homicide, when you're involved in homicides, and you two guys would know this, sometimes your affiliation with a family never ends.
Yeah. Yep.
And you're friends with that family for the rest of your life. I've had several families like that in Austin that has occurred on cases that I've worked either at the police department in the repeat offender program or as a prosecutor.
Well, that trust that you gain with those family members, you can never give that up.
You can never give that up. And, it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
It really is. It's what makes it worth it. It's why y'all went into this profession, why y'all did what you did and do what you do. Yeah. But that's why law enforcement's a wonderful thing. And I've got a case I'm going to be writing a book starting in the end of this year on a case I prosecuted in 1988 where a police dispatcher's daughter was killed in 1979 here in Austin, Sidney Myers. And I went to high school with the victim.
Oh, wow.
And ended up prosecuting the case. And it's a real, real interesting.
Well, I'll tell you what, when you get done writing the book, we can come on here.
Yeah.
And we can talk about it and debut it. And we can help you push that.
We'll do it. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's an interesting case. And she was a wonderful girl. I actually went to junior high school and high school with the victim. And miss her to this day.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I want to link him up sometime too with Wayman Lewis. We had Wayman Lewis on here and he was his first week on the job when the tower shooting occurred. And he had a rifle in the, I think, the architecture building.
Yeah. Chicken joint.
Borrowed a rifle, got in the architecture building in his first week on the job at APD.
Amazing.
And you guys would, he loves Austin.
Yeah, I was playing soccer in the backyard in 1966 when that occurred. I remember, and we all ran inside, and we were watching the live feed from the public television station right next to UT. We could see the smoke from Whitman's rifle coming off.
Wow.
It was amazing. That was a big day in Austin.
Changed we had everything. Him on the podcast. I'll have to send you the link.
Yeah, that's an incredible story that y'all have linked up with him. That's awesome.
So my question 2 and 3. You have a hell of a career. You've done enough different things for 2 or 3 people, state rep, sheriff, prosecutor, still going strong, volunteering your time, helping victims. I mean, a hell of a career.
Yeah. Thank you.
Through all that you've done, through all you've seen, through all you've experienced, what was your very, very best day and what was your worst day?
That's easy on the worst day. And y'all have been there too, is when you have to tell someone their loved one has been killed, it's murdered. And in particular, one that was tough for me, I'm going to try not to get emotional. I had to call the parents of an infant who had been kidnapped and we thought possibly was still alive. But the kidnapper killed the baby and we found the baby in a rural field in Bell County. And I had to get on the phone and call the parents and tell them, no, the baby's dead. That was rough. That was the Brandon Baugh case. That one was tough because we had been working on it for days. Even though when we had the FBI involved and we had a suspect out of state and we had to bring her back and she had drawn a crude map and we had to play hardball to get it. And I even had to go to court to get it. And I got a lot of criticism from forcing that from the attorney for that suspect from the local newspaper, which took the side of the attorney. But ultimately, the Court of Criminal Appeals ruled in my favor, which wasn't reported by the paper later. But that was a tough day. To this day, it bothers me, you know, and other cases like that involved infants, I think. Best day, you know, there were a lot of those. I'll tell you, the night I won that election for sheriff, which wasn't supposed to happen and which went against all political prognostications, and everyone said I couldn't win it, and that night, about midnight that night, when the clerk had to grudgingly admit, oh, he's got a lead that isn't going to be overcome, I was like, yes! And my brothers and I we were like high-fiving it, and it was just a blast. That was a great day. And, you know, starting, it was a great day when the first day I walked in and worked for Ronnie Earl, too. It was a great day. I can't really convey how what that was like working for him. I guess it would be what I'd give you as an analogy is if you were, like, going to go work for Bob Bullock, you know. Yeah. It was like, you know, this for me at a local level was like, holy smoke, you know. He was the kind of guy I'd want his autograph, you know.
Yeah.
So those were great days.
With all you've done, you've probably been a lot of good days.
Oh, yeah.
It was a lot of good days. We had a lot of fun. The funnest time I had was the 5 years, I was actually physically co-located with the police at the police department, and they adopted me and took me in like one of their own. It was great. Well, that sounds I trained with them, and it was wonderful. It was, and to this day, those guys, and I haven't seen a lot of them in years. I do still stay in touch with some of them every day, but they made me an honorary member of the Austin Police Association. Oh, cool. They gave me all these awards that are on my website, you know, and it's like I look at them now and I'm like, wow, you know, once upon a time, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
That's cool.
And, yeah, it really was. They treated me great. That was a real brotherhood and sisterhood there at the Austin Police Department back in those days. It still is.
Yeah.
You know, that's still healthy over there in that regard.
Yeah.
It's just officials. Yeah, you know, we had the support of the county attorney, the district attorney, the governor, the mayor, you know, the city council. We were able to do good for people in the city of Austin. We did amazing things following serial robbers and taking down drug dealers and arresting murderers. You know, we did amazing things. Yeah. And it's really... I feel bad for people going into law enforcement now here because they're at such a disadvantage compared to the support system we had back then.
Yeah.
And we had cops go bad back then, and we had them held accountable. But it wasn't perfect, and it wasn't a perfect system, but it was a functioning, you know, it wasn't dysfunctional like it is now with the DA. It was a functioning system.
Listening to you talk reminds me a lot. We lost a legend for us. Mario Martinez was a lobbyist. He'd been a lobbyist 45 years, I think, inside the Capitol down there. And listening to you talk and being old school, original Austin, I would walk the halls with Mario. And Austin's a massive city, but it's kind of a small. A lot of people are connected, and they go back.
Yeah.
They go back decades, and they know each other's family members. And
yeah.
When you get behind the barriers of the madness of Austin,
yeah,
it's kind of a small, it's not a small town,
yeah,
but there's a lot of people have been around a long time, and a lot of it's a connected place.
It's exactly right.
You know, it's like a neat place.
A lot of good people have passed away, and, but we still are connected. And like, you know, did you hear about, Judge Burt Carnes and his wife were killed in a horrible situation up Williams County. I grew up with that family. The Carnes family lived like four houses down from me. And their father was career FBI. And where I grew up in Northeast Austin, we had two FBI agents, Jimmy Chapman's father and the Carnes father. And we had two Secret Service agents right there next to our, you know, right close to there. It was a middle class neighborhood that was just great.
That's cool.
And that old Austin... it's still there, but you got to kind of look for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's lost to history in some manner. And
people like you are trying their damnedest to, you know, to bring that back. And so,
yeah,
we thank you for it.
Well, that's how I got elected sheriff. And I got to thank everybody out there listening who was part of that, because really that's what got me elected, for those connections to the old Austin.
Yeah.
And the police believing in what I can do. So,
well, we're going to continue this friendship. I know between you and I and hey, I look forward to it. I appreciate you answering the phone on a Sunday.
Oh, glad to do it. If I can ever do anything for TMPA, let me know. And I appreciate what y'all do. And I tell everyone who's, you know, civilians that aren't in law enforcement, I say, man, let me tell you something. If it weren't for the police groups, the police would be completely steamrolled, and there would be no one to be police.
Well, that's why we have this podcast. You know, that's the number one reason. We're not going to be silenced.
That's good. Y'all are doing a good job. Keep it up.
Appreciate it. You got anything else?
No, sir. I cannot thank you enough for coming on.
It's my honor. Thank you. And again, thank y'all for the award you gave me. And when I was in the legislature, I'll never forget it. That's hanging up at home. And I'll make everybody look at it. So.
Well, this about wraps it up. I'm hearing some thunder outside, so I'm scared that we're going to lose this episode with loss of electricity. You guys stay safe. Again, our thoughts and prayers are with everybody affected by the wildfires in the panhandles. Y'all be careful out there. God bless you, and as always, may God bless Texas. We're out.
We'll be right back.